KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Island of the Blue Foxes, Disaster and Triumph on the World's Greatest Scientific Expedition, by Stephen R. Bowen, narrated by Stephen Crossley. Prologue. The Edge of the World. In the fall of 1741, the Russian vessel St. Peter, more a wreck than a ship, with tattered sails and snapped masts, limped west across the stormy North Pacific Ocean. A chill descended from the north, turning the rain to snow. Ice crusted the rigging and the railings. But the deck was curiously free from activity, as most of the men were lying below in their hammocks, despondent and immobilized from scurvy. When the waves subsided and the skies cleared from the later squall, a handful of mariners came on deck and stared at a distant outcropping of land that one of the officers assured them was Kamchatka. The vessel floated quietly into a harbour and dropped anchor as night fell. When the tide changed, however, a great current spun the ship about, snapped the anchor cable, and dragged the helpless vessel toward a concealed reef. Panic-stricken men dashed about, crying out questions as the hull ground sickeningly on the jagged rocks. If it was sundered, they all knew they would be sucked to their doom in the frigid waters. At the last moment, however, a large wave lifted the battered ship over the reef and deposited it in a shallow lagoon near the shore. Scarcely believing their deliverance, the few reasonably able-bodied men began ferrying the sick, the dead, and supplies to the stony beach, a task that consumed many days because of winds and snow flurries. The sight that greeted them was bleak. Wind-lashed grassy dunes stretched back to a base of low, snow-covered mountains. No sooner had the mariners shambled up the beach than a pack of snarling blue foxes swarmed toward them, began tearing at their pant legs, and had to be driven away with kicks and shouts. A small band of mariners, still strong enough to walk, set out to survey the coast and discover they were on a treeless, uninhabited and uncharted island. They had not, in fact, reached Kamchatka, their home base, but, as they later learned, were somewhere between America and Asia at the end of the Aleutian chain. The men immediately set about searching for shelter against the rapidly approaching winter, and decided to enlarge a series of burrows they found near the dunes and a creek. They collected a rude framework of driftwood to which they affixed fox hides and the tattered remnants of the sails. Hordes of starving foxes swarmed about the makeshift camp, drawn from the barren hills by the scent of food. They stole clothing and blankets, dragged away tools and utensils, and became increasingly aggressive. Scratching at shallow graves, the foxes dragged away corpses and gnawed on them within sight of the enfeebled mariners. For the several dozen men who had scrambled ashore from the ship, things could not have seemed bleaker. The pitiable survivors were to spend the dark winter huddled in a collection of primitive shelters on this stony beachhead, subsisting on whatever animals they could hunt, sucking nourishment from withered roots and grasses, while their numbers dwindled. They had no proper clothing, and only meagre provisions and supplies from the ship. As winter wore on, they endured relentless Arctic winds, waist-deep snow, the ravages of scurvy, and continuous assaults by the feral blue foxes. The St. Peter was one of two ships commissioned for the Great Northern Expedition, also known as the Second Kamchatka Expedition. It was the most ambitious and well-financed scientific voyage in history. Lasting nearly 10 years and spanning three continents, its geographic, cartographic, and natural history accomplishments are on a par with James Cook's famous voyages. The scientific circumnavigations of Alessandro Malaspina and Louis-Antoine de Bougainville, and Lewis and Clark's cross-continental trek. The observations of the expedition's naturalist, German Georg Steller, gave Europe its first scientific description of Pacific America's flora and fauna, including the Steller's sea lion, Steller's sea cow, and Steller's jay. Conceived by Russia's Peter the Great in the early 1720s, and led by Danish mariner Vitus Bering, the cost of this incredible enterprise was about 1.5 million rubles, an astonishing one-sixth of the annual income of the Russian state. Yet despite the lavish financing and lofty goals, the Great Northern Expedition is also one of the Age of Sail's darkest tales of shipwreck, suffering, and survival. The Great Northern Expedition was intended to show Europe the grandeur and sophistication of Russia, while extending its imperial boundaries throughout Northern Asia and across the Pacific Ocean to America. The scientific goals, though tethered to the interest of the state, were staggering in their scope. Russia had only recently been transformed, in the estimation of Western European nations, from a barbarous backwater to a somewhat civilized state. The politics in Russia at the time were dangerous, corrupt, and fickle, as many of the expedition members found out during and after their years on the frontier. Bering's original proposal for a voyage of exploration was modest, but when he saw his final instructions from Empress Anna, they had swollen to grandiose proportions. He would be at the head of a huge troop of nearly 3,000 scientists, secretaries, students, interpreters, artists, surveyors, naval officers, mariners, soldiers, and skilled laborers, all of whom had first to cross through Siberia, and many of whom had to travel as far as the eastern coast of Kamchatka. They had to trek across 5,000 miles of roadless forests, swamps, and tundra, along with the supply of tools, iron, canvas, food and medicine, libraries, and scientific implements. Bering's second in command would be the impetuous and proud Russian officer Alexei Chirikov, both men veterans of a previous major expedition. The scientific objectives were equally vast and included investigating the flora, fauna, and minerals of Siberia, as well as settling outlandish rumors about the Siberian peoples. Most important, the expedition was intended to consolidate Russian political control over the entire region, and somehow promote the Russian settlement of Okhotsk and Kamchatka, found schools, introduce cattle raising, discover and operate iron mines and a smelter, and construct a dockyard for deep-water ships. Once the weary cavalcade arrived in Okhotsk, Bering was supposed to build ships and sail south, to survey the northern coast of Japan and the Kuril Islands. Then he was ordered to build two more ships and sail to Kamchatka, found an outpost, and then sail east to Pacific America, where it was hoped the group would explore the coastline as far south as California. It was a wildly ambitious project that an absolute dictator with unlimited resources might possibly have accomplished. But Bering had to contend with both limited supplies and an awkward hierarchy. At any time, Bering's commands could be and sometimes were unexpectedly countermanded by additional directives from St. Petersburg, usually a result of slanderous letters dispatched by those under his command who didn't agree with his decisions. The expedition was a venomous circle of striving, conniving, and self-interest. Ill fortune plagued the expedition. In June 1741, after years spent crossing Siberia, and just as shipwrights had finally built and outfitted the St. Peter and the St. Paul, a supply ship carrying most of the provisions for the voyage ran aground on a sandbar. When the two ships sailed to America, they did so with food for only one summer, not the period of 2 years that was originally planned. Disagreements between the officers began as soon as the shore receded from sight, and the sister ships headed east with no clear directive. The approximately 150 men on board were destined for one of the most tragic and ghastly trials of suffering in the annals of maritime and Arctic history. Part 1. Europe. Chapter 1. The Great Embassy. On the morning of September the 5th, 1698, Peter Alexeyevich Romanov awoke in the chambers of his wooden house near the Kremlin with purpose and determination. He had just returned from 18 months of travel in Western Europe, full of new ideas to modernize the traditions of the Russian state and eager to begin implementing them. Soon a crowd of boyars, the most senior aristocrats, and prominent officials had gathered on the street to welcome him home and to publicly demonstrate their loyalty, for a rebellion had only recently been suppressed. Several of the closest courtiers prostrated themselves, grovelling before him in the traditional manner. A few murmurs spread through the crowd, when, instead of accepting as his due the promptitude of their obsequiousness, he instead lifted them up graciously from their grovelling posture and embraced them with a kiss, such as is due only among private friends. This breach of protocol was mildly disturbing, but Peter had set his mind on a course of action, and it was merely the first departure of the day from Muscovite propriety. The young Tsar, then 26 years old, moved among the crowd, embracing his officials and nodding at their welcomes. He then reached into his coat, produced a razor, and without warning grabbed the long beard of the commander of his armed forces, Alexis Sheen. He cut through the dense strands, letting them fall to the ground. Too astonished to do anything, Sheen stood immobile while Peter finished a rough shave of his beard. Peter then reached for the next closest boyar and rudely trimmed that man's beard. He worked his way through nearly all of those present, his most loyal and senior inner circle of advisers, until they had been shorn of their beards. Each one stood silent, none daring to voice opposition to the power of the Tsar, and in particular Peter, who had already earned a reputation for ruthlessness and an unpredictable temper. Only 3 men were spared the indignity. An older man, who Peter felt had earned the right to a beard, the patriarch of the Orthodox Church, and the personal bodyguard of his estranged wife, Eudoxia Lopukhina, whom he was about to force into a convent. Astonished and speechless, many of the highest-ranking social, political, and military men in the nation now sported new faces. There were a few bouts of nervous laughter. To some, the shaving of a beard was a direct assault on their religion. Under Peter's reign, it would be not only foreign merchants, engineers, and military personnel who strode the streets of Moscow beardless in the later 17th century, but Peter himself wore no beard, in defiance of convention, and others soon followed. Peter's grand tour of Western Europe, sometimes called his Great Embassy, had convinced him that Russia was a backward country in serious need of reforms on many levels of society, and that it had failed to benefit from the technological advances then sweeping nations like Germany, the Netherlands, and England. He was saddened to discover that these nations considered Russia not quite part of Europe. A semi-oriental backwater with its onion dome architecture, rigid Orthodox church, and medieval political institutions. Russia had not yet felt the touch of the Enlightenment. People's minds, in Peter's estimation, were still shackled to outmoded social belief systems, and he was determined to haul his country by whatever means into the orbit of Europe and into an era of what he considered modern thinking. The elaborate and ornate robes that impeded walking and physical work and the long coiffed beards made Russia a laughing stock in Western Europe, and Peter was determined to put an end to these symbols of backwardness. Peter saw these customs as a hindrance to the nation's chances of modernizing. He issued decrees that regulated what was deemed acceptable clothing at official ceremonies or functions, and what all government officials should wear while performing their duties. Waistcoats, breeches, gaiters, low boots, and stylish hats for men. Women could don petticoats, skirts, and bonnets. He also banned the practice of wearing long curved knives at the waist. Anyone wearing old-style dress had to pay a special fee to enter the city, and in time Peter ordered guards at the city gates to cut off the robes of anyone, no matter their status, as a requirement for entering the city. While Peter was enacting his dress and personal grooming reforms, he was also punishing the conspirators who had sought to place his elder half-sister Sophia on the throne during his absence. A rebellion by elements of the Streltsy, Russia's elite military corps. This no doubt added an undercurrent of fear to his beard and clothing declarations. Although the rebellion was short and easily repressed by loyalists, Peter had already endured other uprisings by the Streltsy and by his half-sister while he was still a child. This time, his patience was short. Sophia was forced to become a nun and renounce her name and position in the aristocracy. He disbanded the Streltsy, and more than 1,700 of the surviving conspirators were tortured in specially converted cells in Moscow in an effort to uncover the leaders of the conspiracy. Peter occasionally took a personal role as inquisitor, growling, "Confess, beast, confess," while flesh was flayed, beaten, and burned. In the Great Purge, around 1,200 were killed by hanging or beheading. Many hundreds of bodies left on public display, while many hundreds of others were maimed and exiled to Siberia or other remote rural areas, their widows and children driven from Moscow. It served amply as a warning to any would-be rebels, or anyone else who might think of challenging his decrees. Peter eventually disbanded the regiments of the Streltsy in favour of his newly formed Imperial Guards. In the violent context of the 18th century, Peter's actions appear to have been done not to satisfy his sadistic urges, but rather for reasons of state, to eliminate treason and provide political stability. He berated a church official who appeared before him to beg for leniency for the traitors. "It is the duty of my sovereign office, and a duty that I owe to God, to save my people from harm, and to prosecute with public vengeance crimes that lead to the common ruin." The purge solidified his power through fear and example, so now none would rise to challenge the European reforms that he planned for his country. In a famous painting created during his visit to England, Peter looks resplendent in polished armour and a heavy gilded ermine cape. His stance is bold. One arm grips a rod, while the other is defiantly placed on his hip. Warships with billowed sails can be seen in the background through a window over his shoulder. His eyes are wide and his lips full, his hair curled and artfully ruffled. His head seems disproportionately small for his body, which is encased in its finery and steel. Peter was an unusually tall and striking individual. At more than 6'7", he towered over most of his contemporaries. But he was also narrow-shouldered, and his hands and feet were notably small in relation to his long body. While vigorous and stubborn, he suffered a mild form of epilepsy and had obvious facial tics. Sophia, the widowed electress or ruler of Hanover, provided a detailed description of her meeting with Peter in the summer of 1697, and pronounced that he is a prince at once very good and very bad. His character is exactly that of his country. At the time of Peter's great embassy to Europe in the spring of 1697, no Russian Tsar had ever travelled abroad, at least not without an invading army, particularly into such distant territory. But Peter had already embarked on schemes to break this isolation. He began by expanding his fleet so that Russia wouldn't be essentially landlocked, with only a remote port at Arkhangelsk on the White Sea in the far north. The Baltic was controlled by Sweden, while the Caspian and the Black Seas were under the sway of the Safavid and Ottoman empires. Peter had attacked the Ottoman fortress of Azov at the outlet of the Don River and seized the fortress in 1696. To defend his new territory, he began building a stronger navy, sending dozens of young men to Western Europe to learn seamanship and naval strategy. Peter then announced that he would be organizing a journey of more than 250 high-ranking Russians to the capitals of Western Europe. Even more shocking was the rumor that he planned to go himself, to see the world and form his own opinions, to help set Russia on the path to greatness and prosperity. Only 3 years after the death of his mother, when he had assumed full authority as Tsar, the young autocrat wanted to travel in disguise, as a mere member of an ambassador's entourage. To understand how this greater world worked, how best to achieve his ambitious goals, Peter planned to avoid pompous ceremony and political displays of honor. Ambassadors to his court reported to their respective countries and speculated that Peter's most likely reasons were for personal amusement, a little diversion and holiday, to see how regular people live their lives and to make himself a better ruler. Peter also knew he needed allies in his struggle against the Ottoman Turks. The great embassy made plans to visit the capitals of Warsaw, Vienna, and Venice, as well as Amsterdam and London. He would not travel to France to see the famous Sun King Louis XIV, as France was then allied with the Ottomans. While Peter undoubtedly had a healthy ego, being raised a prince, he was also humble and insightful enough to realize that he and Russia had a lot to learn if he was to take advantage of the new technology and knowledge of the age. Writing later in life, Peter observed that he turned his whole mind to the construction of a fleet. A suitable place for shipbuilding was found on the river Voronezh. Skillful shipwrights were called from England and Holland, and in 1696 there began a new work in Russia, the construction of great warships, galleys, and other vessels. And that the monarch might not be shamefully behind his subjects in that trade, he himself undertook a journey to Holland, and in Amsterdam at the East India Wharf, giving himself up with other volunteers to the learning of naval architecture, he got what was necessary for a good carpenter to know, and, by his own work and skill, constructed and launched a new ship. Peter Mikhailov, as he would be known, also craved freedom. To see and hear and observe for himself the state of the world and not be hidden behind a facade of luxury and ceremony. He didn't care to spend his days just swanning with royalty. Rather, he preferred to have the freedom to come and go anonymously. He wanted Russia to become part of the exciting world of Western Europe, and the new lands that its mariners have been exploring and were continuing to explore with their fleets. The world was becoming globalized in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, and Western Europe was the technological and inspirational epicenter of this endeavor. New technologies such as clocks or chronometers, compasses, thermometers, telescopes, barometers, and instruments for accurate cartography supported navigation and exploration. The enterprising mariners and financiers of the Dutch and English East India Companies, as well as the Dutch West India Company, were bringing coffee, tea, sugar, and spices such as cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg to European markets. Exotic plants and animals were in everyday use. Freed to a certain extent from religious dogma, scientists such as Descartes, Leibniz, Leeuwenhoek, and Newton were actively experimenting and exploring the natural environment and the properties and principles that governed the world. This new science was changing the European worldview, and Peter didn't want to miss out personally or let Russia be left behind. He also had more prosaic designs. He purchased new ship cannons, rigging, anchors, sails, and the latest instruments of navigation, so that they could be better understood and replicated in Russia to improve the economy. Most people in the 17th and 18th centuries lived in rural environments, engaged in some activity directly related to farming with animals. Water wheels and windmills provided the only energy beyond sheer muscle power. People seldom travelled as the roads were poor and surplus food or time was scarce. Daily life began with the rising of the sun and ended after dark. Wood was the only source of light and heat. Russia, being on the geographical fringe of Europe, was not part of the transfer of new ideas and knowledge then sweeping the continent, and Peter wanted that to change, to bring about a new way of life for his people. The thought of a Russian great embassy did not bring joy to the courts of the countries that were to receive the group. The Russian ambassadors of the time knew little of the customs of other nations, and consequently had difficulty communicating their ideas. They were usually seen as rude and uncouth, bumpkins who refused to follow the protocols of courtly behaviour common in Western Europe. The Russian court itself was seen as beyond the pale. According to the Austrian ambassador's secretary, Johann Georg Korb, meals at the Russian court were frequently unscheduled and abruptly preceded by the announcement that the Tsar wants to eat. Servants would promptly arrive with platters of food and place them on the huge table, seemingly at random, while people grabbed for them, perhaps hitting each other jokingly with long loaves of bread or squabbling over the great bowls of wine, mead, beer, and brandy. Heavy drinking was common along with heated arguments, lively dancing, and even wrestling. Trained bears sometimes roamed to the dining hall, proffering cups of peppery brandy and knocking off hats and wigs to much merriment. These antics, while no doubt amusing to the Muscovites in Peter's court, were not much appreciated by European dignitaries preoccupied with the order and timing of entering rooms and table seating, with which long-winded title each person was to be addressed, with which cup to drink from, and in which order to eat the varied dishes. Peter particularly disliked official or formal functions, considering them to be barbarous and inhumane, preventing monarchs from enjoying the society of mankind. He wanted to talk and dine, drink and joke with people of all ranks, while being the first among equals naturally. Peter was proud of his calluses, of labouring with shipwrights, of marching with his soldiers, of working the ropes on a ship, of drinking beer with craftsmen. He was eager to meet with men who had risen to respect out of merit rather than birth or influence. Peter personally chose the members of his great embassy, and the sprawling cavalcade included not only his three principal ambassadors, senior members of Peter's nobility, but also 20 other aristocrats and 35 skilled artisans. They would all travel together, in addition to priests, musicians, interpreters, cooks, horsemen, soldiers, and other servants. Peter Mikhailov, a nondescript, brown-haired, blue-eyed jack-of-all-trades, noteworthy only for his height, joined the ranks. It would be an open secret that he was travelling with the embassy, but it was not to be officially acknowledged, which created unusual dilemmas with protocol. Peter left Russia in the hands of three older trustworthy men, a regency council that included one of his uncles. The great embassy set off overland through the Swedish-controlled territory that bordered the eastern Baltic, which included Finland, Estonia, and Latvia. Here Peter paid particular attention to the fortifications of the city of Riga, a fortress that his father had failed to conquer 40 years earlier, and that would be a nicely situated place for a Russian port on the Baltic Sea. He considered his reception here to be rude and inhospitable, not fit for a czar. Of course, he was travelling incognito, but he still expected to see the recognition that he was there. Having his entourage ignored and left to fend for themselves and to pay high prices for their food and lodging was not acceptable. 3 years later, Peter would use this apparent or perceived ill-treatment in Riga as an excuse for starting the war that would consume most of his life and reign, the Great Northern War with Sweden. Riga would eventually be incorporated into the Russian Empire. Certainly it was convenient that he was treated so poorly there, since there was no other way for him to expand Russia and gain access to the Baltic Sea than by seizing Swedish-held territory. The cavalcade then travelled overland to Mitau in Poland. Growing impatient, Peter boarded a private yacht and sailed ahead to the northern German city of Königsberg, where Frederick III, the Elector of Brandenburg, met him to discuss an alliance against Sweden. Like Peter, Frederick also wanted to expand his territory to become king of a newly formed Kingdom of Prussia. After laying the foundation for future joint military action against Sweden, Peter continued overland to Berlin. By this time his presence was an open secret, and word travelled throughout northern Europe. People thronged to see the Tsar of the mysterious eastern land with the outlandishly dressed people and the Oriental customs, known for their hard drinking and barbaric behaviour. The great embassy became like a travelling circus, and Peter was annoyed at the intrusive scrutiny as if he were a curiosity, which he was. But he was a charming curiosity, well liked by the gentry of Germany for his good humour, fun-loving displays, and lively conversation. He proved to be nowhere near as uncivilised a bear as had been reported. His many foreign tutors had prepared him well. In mid-August, Peter and a handful of compatriots, upon reaching the Rhine, boarded a small boat and sailed downstream, leaving the bulk of the great embassy to plod along by land. He sailed right through Amsterdam to the Dutch town of Zaandam, where, in his quixotic manner, he wanted to enlist as a carpenter and learn shipbuilding as if he were a common labourer. He set himself up in a small wooden house close by the shipyards, purchased some carpentry tools, and signed on to build ships. His anonymity was soon questioned, as rumour spread of foreigners in strange costumes having arrived by ship. Crowds were staring at his troop in their ostentatious Russian dress. Peter also stood out because of his unusual height and distinctive facial tics, and within days he was politely declining offers to dine with the leading officials and merchants of the town. Soon his presence was causing a sensation throughout the Republic. people came from Amsterdam to see if the rumours were true, that the Tsar of Muscovy was working on ships as a common labourer. And soon, fences had to be erected around the worksite to keep the crowds of gawkers at bay. The next day he grew impatient and forced his way through the throngs, boarded his small ship and sailed to Amsterdam, where he went directly to the large inn reserved for the embassy. In Amsterdam, which was much larger and more accustomed to worldly happenings, he hoped to blend in. Water and thousands of ships surrounded him everywhere in this city of canals, and the hollering of sailors was always in the air. He found work at the walled shipyards of the Dutch East India Company, known as the VOC, where there was a fleet of ships of different shapes and sizes. Some were being constructed while older ones had been dragged above the tide line and lay like the decaying rib cages of sea monsters, rotted planking being torn away and replaced over the skeleton. Ropes and wood and tar and cloth and iron were being moulded into vessels of commerce and war, and it was here that Peter spent months gaining a familiarity with all things nautical. But he no longer strove for anonymity. Instead, he met with the burgomaster and leading city dignitaries. The VOC offered him a small house within the walls of the compound to keep prying eyes at bay. He and 10 other Russians would begin work on a new 100-foot frigate to see and participate in its construction from the ground up, from inspecting the logs and materials to overseeing the design plans. The VOC renamed the ship in his honour the Apostles Peter and Paul. What was most shocking to the young Tsar were the density and wealth of the Dutch Republic. With about 2 million people in a small country, its cities were huge by comparison to those in other lands. The Dutch Republic was at its pinnacle of prestige, from the wealth that flowed from the Dutch East India Company, and it was then the richest, most urbanized, and most sophisticated nation in Europe, renowned for its art and clothing, food, spices, and thinkers. Its teeming shipyards serviced a trade network that was then the largest in the world, with ships that sailed nearly everywhere European ships could navigate, everywhere except for the North Pacific. The mighty commercial enterprise transformed the nation and then Europe. The VOC alone employed more than 50,000 people, sailors, artisans, labourers, stevedores, clerks, carpenters, and soldiers. Other Dutch companies fed off the commercial activities of the VOC, and they collectively controlled vast quantities of the trade in Northern Europe. The immense wealth this trade produced helped to stimulate the Dutch Golden Age, an era when the Netherlands was the wealthiest and most scientifically advanced of European nations, with flourishing arts and sciences from painting, sculpture, architecture and drama to philosophy, law, mathematics and publishing. Peter had never before seen anything like it. In Amsterdam, forests of shipmasts congregated in the protected harbour. Smaller ships lined endless wharves and canals indented the city with heavily laden barges. All this activity was also spurring the development of new financial structures to control and enable it. Credit, insurance, loans, the joint stock company. People from around Europe came to learn methods of commerce and other skills related to the new global trade that extended from regions as far away as the Pacific Ocean. That ocean, Peter was aware, lay at the terminus of his vast, sprawling empire, the little explored and poorly charted eastern land known as Kamchatka, which at the time was thought possibly to connect to North America. Peter spent 4 months working in the Amsterdam shipyards and touring the other cities of the Dutch Republic. On November the 16th, 1697, the frigate Peter was working on was launched to great ceremony, and then presented to him by the VOC as a gift. The ship, which Peter renamed Amsterdam in honour of his hosts, was eventually loaded with all of the examples of European industry that the Russian contingent had been buying, and set sail for still the only Russian port in Europe, Arkhangelsk, on the White Sea. In January 1698, Peter and a handful of chosen compatriots set off for England at King William's invitation, leaving most of his embassy in Amsterdam. He was to be presented with a new yacht as a gift from the king, and he wanted to compare English shipbuilding techniques to those of the Dutch. The city of London also amazed him. At around 750,000 people, it was on par with Amsterdam and Paris. The Thames was crowded with vessels of all sizes. England and the Dutch Republic fought three wars during the 17th century, grappling for supremacy of the world's trade routes to India and the Spice Islands. As in Amsterdam, by this time much of London's wealth was arriving from destinations outside Europe, from America, the Caribbean, India, Indonesia, and even China. Peter was particularly interested in how the British tax system and economy provided the government with revenues for constructing and maintaining the mighty navies that were bringing the wealth of the world to its shores. He was searching for evidence of how to transform his mostly rural nation with an agrarian economy into something resembling a modern European nation with a skilled urban population. Peter spent months working in and touring the king's shipyards, and along with his Russian cohorts, earned a reputation for rowdy, unrefined behaviour. Peter's strong opinions were noted, as were his insatiable curiosity and fiery temper. He also toured the Royal Mint, and later used its example as a foundation for his reforms of the Russian currency. Here, and in Amsterdam, he interviewed and hired skilled craftsmen and engineers, physicians and tradesmen such as stonemasons, locksmiths and shipwrights, as well as mariners and navigators. The wages he offered were good enough to induce many to leave home and move to Russia. In mid-July, as he was readying to depart Vienna, Peter received news of the Streltsy's uprising and the march on the Kremlin with the support of his half-sister Sophia. He cancelled the final destination of his tour, Venice, and rushed back through Poland to Moscow, riding day and night, stopping only to change horses, no doubt thinking about the great beards he was about to shave. After countering the uprising on his return to Moscow, Peter began implementing his ideas about how a modern state should be structured and governed. He had dwelled on the institutions lacking in his home that he admired in Holland, Germany, and England. The new beard laws and the beard tax were just the first of many actions that he intended to shake Russia from its somnolence. The next 25 years of Peter's long reign would be taken up with two main priorities, the first of which was a series of radical institutional changes to Russian society, remodelling it along European lines. During the decades after his return from the Great Embassy, he adopted the clothes, style, friends and habits of foreigners, had many foreign friends and advisers, and strove for many years to stamp out the orthodox belief that foreigners were a source of heresy and contamination. He trimmed the power of the Orthodox Church, introduced calendrical reform, expanded and restructured the army, standardized the coinage, introduced official stamped paper for legal documents, and created state awards. A lifelong pipe smoker, a habit he picked up from his German and Dutch friends, Peter also legalized tobacco. At one time during his grandfather's reign, smoking had been punishable by death, with the penalty later liberalized to having one's nostrils slit. Since no one was going to be slitting the Tsar's nostrils, the church put up little fight against decriminalizing tobacco. he founded the Academy of Sciences, staffed chiefly with foreign intellectuals. Peter was also against strict arranged marriages, a tradition that he had personally experienced that was not in evidence in Holland, Germany, or England. He had been married according to this tradition by his mother when he was a teenager and unable to resist. Peter determined to be rid of his then wife Eudoxia Lupukina, a mournful and pious woman whom he rarely saw or spoke with. He had not written her a single note during his 18-month absence in Europe, and did not rush to see her upon his return. He had her put in a nunnery, and removed from the palace and public life. In 1703, he met Marta Skavronskaya, a Lithuanian peasant in domestic service, who became his mistress, then wife, and finally Empress Catherine. After the political and social reforms, the second major accomplishment of Peter's reign was to launch the war with Sweden, the Great Northern War, a long string of battles of conquest that secured lands along the eastern Baltic coast and tilted the nation westward toward Europe. In this new territory, in 1703, Peter founded a new city. Situated on the eastern coast of the Gulf of Finland, at one time part of Russia but more recently controlled by Sweden, the city was to be a model for Russia. He named it St. Petersburg. Peter was so anxious that the city be built on a new modern plan and be built quickly that he passed an edict that no stone construction would be permitted elsewhere in Russia. All Russian stonemasons had to work on his new city until it was completed. Here, he headquartered the Russian navy and expanded it, using the host of artisans and tradesmen he had recruited during his great embassy. The new city became the centre of his government and court. On September the 10th, 1721, Russia and Sweden ended the 21-year Great Northern War when they signed the Treaty of Nystad, the same year that Peter added the honorific Emperor of All Russia to his official title. During the war, Russia had conquered much of the eastern Baltic and Finland, and Peter agreed to pay a large sum in silver to Sweden in exchange for keeping Estonia, Livonia, Ingria, and southeastern Finland as part of the Russian Empire. Peter led as accomplished and colourful a life to rival that of any grand monarch. He had done more than any other Russian leader to restructure the nation and set it on a modern path. And he still had grand plans. Not for nothing was he called Peter the Great. But in the summer of 1724, after decades in power, he became seriously ill, was perhaps even dying despite his relative youth. His physicians opened his abdomen and pierced his bladder, releasing 4 pounds of urine that had been painfully building inside him. He rallied in the fall, but by December he was again bedridden and in daily pain. Peter could have looked back on a career of unparalleled accomplishment and success, a life of drama and adventure that had seen Russia transformed from an ignorant medieval backwater to one of Europe's preeminent nations. Yet he was not content to linger on past glories. He was dreaming of one long-desired geographical and scientific ambition, a final act that would elevate even further the Russian state in the estimation of European nations and the scientific community, as well as consolidate his grasp on the farthest-flung reaches of his vast and sprawling empire. As he lay in the imperial splendour of his apartments in the palace, grounded by his illness, he was thinking about something new. A final, brilliant cap to an illustrious career and life. He scrawled out a set of instructions, a command that would have repercussions for many decades and lead to one of the greatest scientific expeditions in history and the discovery of a sea route to a new land. In his final days, One of Peter's great interests was in geography and determining the extent and resources of the farthest districts of his empire, as well as a long-time pet interest, the relationship between Asia and North America. This was a great geographical mystery that lay, in this era before the American Revolution and Captain Cook's voyages, in one of the final uncharted parts of the globe, the North Pacific Ocean. In the waning days of 1724, Peter spoke to his closest advisor from his deathbed. He outlined his ideas and plans to his attendants and, concerned that his end was near, was eager to get the expedition underway. Calling the General Admiral Kantaprexin, Fyodor Matveyevich, to his bedside, he said, "Bad health has obliged me to remain home. Recently, I have been thinking over a matter which has been on my mind for many years, but other affairs have prevented me from carrying it out. I have reference to the finding of a passage to China and India through the Arctic Sea. On the map before me there is indicated such a passage bearing the name of Anian. There must be some reason for that. In my last travels I discussed the subject with learned men, and they were of opinion that such a passage could be found. Now that the country is in no danger from enemies, we should strive to win for her glory along the lines of the arts and sciences. In seeking such a passage, who knows but perhaps we may be more successful than the Dutch and English, who have made many attempts along the American coast." He handed over to the Count the instructions written in his own hand on December the 23rd, 1724, although he did not sign the official document for another month, on January the 26th, 1725. Peter's instructions were concise, considering their long-term impact on world history. 1. To build in Kamchatka or in some other place one or two decked boats. 2. To sail on these boats along the shore which runs to the north, and which, since its limits are unknown, seems to be a part of the American coast. 3. To determine where it joins America. To sail to some settlement under European jurisdiction, and if a European ship should be met with, learn from her the name of the coast and take it down in writing. Make a landing, obtain information, draw a chart, and bring it here. 1 month after drawing up these plans for the first major Russian exploration, later to be called the First Kamchatka Expedition, one that would fill the geographical gaps left by other European nations and become a symbol of the awakening of the Russian Empire, Peter the Great died on February the 8th, 1725, at age 52. His widow, Catherine, became the new empress, and she continued to support her husband's dream. Peter had chosen a 20-year veteran of his navy and the Great Northern War to lead the expedition, a mature and respected Danish commander named Vitus Bering.
Through that door I carried you not long ago. You were mine and I was oh so proud. But you left me, and why, I guess I'll never know. And now I watch that door and cry out loud. For through that door you walked away and left me. But through that door I hope that you'll walk back again. So please remember, if you ever need a friend, the door that let you out will let you in. Ah, buddy, now. Mm-hmm. million years is not enough to let you know how many times I've wished that you'd walk back once more. I sit alone and ask myself, why did you go? And almost wish I'd never seen that door. Walk through that door, you walked away and left me. But through that door, I hope that you'll walk back again. So please remember, if you ever need a friend, the door that led you out will let
untie the ribbons that hold your inhibitions. Turn your lamplight down. Unlock the door closed by traditions. It won't make a sound. Covers that cloak your apprehensions, let them fall to the floor. All I have are these gentle intentions. Don't be afraid anymore.
When I'm 65 and you are 64, we can settle down in a house on Tampa Bay and reminisce about our lives together and apart, and the fine and fancy funny folks we met along the way. But now I've got to play guitar in someone else's band, play the songs that he tells me to play. I don't wanna stand behind someone else's dreams, 'cause I've got songs inside of me I wanna sing myself someday. But until that day, this lonesome road is beckoning me on, and you know I gotta travel it alone. So I'll see you when I see you, and I'll love you when I do. Then I'll sing for you another goodbye song.